Hello there, I'm Rob, and you're listening to the Black Country Talking News, and this week's edition is for the 1st of December 2021.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by sight loss charity Beacon Centre. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. All you need to do is say, "Alexa, play Black Country Talking News." Our Talking News service is also available via the following methods: calling 01902 213 210, visiting our website www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast on the Black Country Radio website, on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by simply searching Beacon Black Country Talking News and hitting the subscribe button, and on your mobile or tablet device by downloading the free British Wireless for the Blind Talking News application from your App Store. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Thank you, Simon. Appearing this week, we have myself, Rob, Mina, Craig, Helen, Simon, Christine, Nikki, Graham, Anne, Ashley, Deborah, and of course, Flashback Roger. As mentioned last week, this week's edition is a collection of features and articles. Our normal service will resume next week. On track 5, we have the Beacon update. Track 6 is information about MasterCard's Touch Card, designed for people with sight loss. At track 7, we have the quiz questions. Track 8 is information about Beacon's on-call service. Number 9 is an interview with Mina about her experience volunteering at the Beacon Centre. Track 10 is an article looking at whether Oliver Cromwell actually banned Christmas. On track 11, it's Flashback Roger and his Did You Know feature. Number 12 is an opportunity to join the Citizens Network. Track 13 takes a look back at the Paralympics. Track 14 is Craig's Black Country Joke Book. On 15, we have this week's quiz answers. Track 16 is an audiobook review of John Wyndham's classic work, The Midwich Cuckoos. And finally, on 17, we get to hear one of Graham Fisher's Flights of Fancy. I hope you enjoy this week's edition, with normal service resuming next week.
Hi everyone, it's Helen. Well, can you believe it? We're heading into December. It seems incredible to think that we're almost in 2022. But before we get there, we've got plenty on throughout December at Beacon to make sure it is your best month yet of 2021. So we've still got some virtual activities, including some with a festive twist taking place throughout the month. You can find our December timetable on our website at www.beaconvision.org/virtual-activities. That's www.beaconvision.org/virtual-activities. Or to find out more about any of our sessions, give Kim Williams a call on 01902 880111 or email her at kwilliams@beaconvision.org. Now, if you haven't already got your Santa Run tickets for December the 5th, you can head to www.beaconvision.org/Santa-run-2021. Registration will open at West Park in Wolverhampton at 9 a.m. and the run will get underway at 9:45 a.m. We're hoping to get as many people as possible there so we can fill the park with Santas. Don't forget, you can take your Santa suit home with you once you've completed the race, and kids will get their own Santa hat. We'll even have a little something special for all our four-legged friends taking part. Next, if you want to win some amazing prizes that will keep you busy through to 2022, don't forget to get your Beacon Christmas raffle ticket in any of our 7 shops, or you can also buy it online via www.justgiving.com/fundraising/Beacon Christmas Raffle 2021. That's www.justgiving.com/fundraising/Beacon Christmas Raffle 2021. The first prize is a signed Wolves football. Meanwhile, if you want to enjoy a festive celebration to remember with family or friends, you can also book a place at one of our community Christmas meal events, where we'll be serving up a four-course menu on December the 14th, 15th, 21st, 22nd and 23rd for just £19.99 per person. Call 01902 880111 or email inquiries@beaconvision.org. That's inquiries@beaconvision.org to book. Having recently sampled the food from our amazing restaurants, I can tell you it'll be a meal to remember. Now, lastly, we know that December is a month of remembrance for many of us, so don't forget, if there's someone you'll be thinking of over the festive season, you can dedicate a light to them on our virtual Christmas tree. Head to www.visufund.com, that's visufund.com/forgetmenot21. So in non-Christmas news this week, and I'll be honest, there's not a lot of non-Christmas news, we need to let you know that for Monday, December the 6th, our Wolverhampton Christmas Clearance Centre will have new opening hours. Do you see what I did there? Almost said Christmas again. Christmas on the brain, I think. We'll still be offering the same great bargains on homeware, furniture and clothes though, so why not come and pay us a visit? You can find us on Lower Walsall Street, just outside the city centre. That's it for now. We'll be back soon with another update. Take care. Bye-bye.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, I'm Nikki, and here's an article from businesswire.com called MasterCard Introduces Accessible Card for Blind and Partially Sighted People. There are few effective ways for the visually impaired to quickly determine whether they're holding a credit, debit, or prepaid card, particularly as more cards move to flat designs without embossed name and numbers. MasterCard is addressing this challenge with a simple yet effective innovation. The touch card will provide a greater sense of security, inclusivity, and independence to the 2.2 billion people around the world with visual impairments, says Raja Rajamana, Chief Marketing and Communications Officer. For the visually impaired, identifying their payment cards is a real struggle. This tactile solution allows consumers to correctly orient the card and know which payment card they are using. With the new touch card, MasterCard has improved upon a current design standard by introducing a system of notches on the side of the card to help consumers use the right card the right way by touch alone. The new touch card credit cards have a round notch, debit cards have a broad squarish notch, and prepaid cards have a triangular notch. The standard has been designed to work with point-of-sale terminals and ATMs, ensuring it can be deployed at scale. MasterCard's concept has been vetted and endorsed by the Royal National Institute of Blind People, RNIB, in the UK, and Visions Services for the Blind and Visually Impaired in the US. The card was co-designed by IDEMIA, the global leader in augmented identity, providing trusted solutions in the physical as well as digital space. As the banking industry responds to new trends and developments, it's critical that any innovation brings progress for everyone, including those with a visual impairment, says David Clark, RNIB's Director of Services. We're very pleased that MasterCard understands how important it is that blind and partially sighted people have equal and independent access to their own finances. Innovation should always be driven by the impulse to include, adds Rajamana, who is also the company's healthcare president. With one in seven people experiencing some form of disability, designing these products with accessibility in mind gives an equal opportunity to benefit from the ease and security of a digital world. No one should be left behind. MasterCard has been embedding its signature melody at checkout counters worldwide, a signal to everyone, the sight impaired in particular, that their card transaction has gone through successfully. MasterCard's launch of the touch card underscores its commitment to inclusivity. It follows the introduction of True Name, designed in support of the transgender and non-binary communities. The company's commitment as a brand is not only stand against inequity, but to be an agent for change.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, and welcome to this week's quiz questions. If you don't know an answer, don't despair, as all the information you need to answer them can be found later in Flashback Rogers' Did You Know section. But for now, here are your questions. Question 1. How long ago was the last ice age? Question 2. Why is December so cold? Question 3. What is the run-up to Christmas called? Question 4. Why is mincemeat in our mince pies so cold? Question 5. Where did the idea of advent calendars originate? And question 6. Who was the Norse goddess of love and beauty? Best of luck with those, and I'll be back later in the show to reveal the answers. Up next, we hear about Beacon's on-call service.
Feeling vulnerable, lonely, or just need to talk? We're here for you. Call 01902 880 111. If you are feeling alone and in need of someone to talk to, we can help. The Beacon Centre and our partners Dudley Mind offer a free befriending service designed especially for older people who might be feeling lonely. You'll receive regular contact from one of our trained and DBS-checked volunteers who will be matched with you based on common interests. They can offer friendship and support, someone to talk to and help you access services that may benefit you. While COVID-19 restrictions are in place, our service is telephone-based, but we can also offer home visits when it is safe to do so. Anyone who lives in Dudley Borough or is registered with a Dudley GP and is over the age of 65 can sign up to receive support. To find out more, or if you would like to become a volunteer caller, please email referrals@beaconvision.org or ring 01902 880 111 Mondays to Fridays.
A quick chat with Talking News volunteer Mina. How did you get involved in volunteering?
The way I got involved in volunteering was through a staff member at Beacon. I was approached as I expressed that I wanted to use my voice with confidence. That's how I got involved in Talking News.
How does your volunteering help?
My volunteering helps the wider community keep up to date with news, sports, various topics that the Talking News offers. And it keeps me connected with the wider community too.
What do you enjoy most about volunteering?
Volunteering gives me great pleasure. It makes me feel valued. And I just really enjoy being connected with the wider community.
How has volunteering benefited you?
Volunteering has definitely benefited me. It's allowed me to connect with a lot more people, and it continues for me to get involved with more and more varieties and different topics through the Talking News.
Would you recommend volunteering to others?
Yes, of course, definitely. I would recommend volunteering to others, as you can take part whatever suits you and how you feel comfortable doing it.
Any other comments?
Volunteering, I think, is a magical thing to do. It gives me a boost. It gives me great pleasure to take part. And I feel valued.
To find out more about volunteering at Beacon, visit beaconvision.org/volunteer.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, this is Anne with an item from the website Historic England. Did Oliver Cromwell really ban Christmas? Oliver Cromwell was born in Huntingdon in Cambridgeshire in 1599 and was Member of Parliament for the town for a year from 1628 to 1629. Today, the statue of him that looks down on the townspeople of nearby St. Ives, where he lived from 1631 to 1636, is listed at Grade 2 in recognition of his importance as a renowned local and national figure. It's a commonly held belief that Cromwell banned Christmas. His reputation as a highly puritanical political leader has always been hotly debated, and as with all controversial figures, myths and legends about his famous zealous character have proliferated. So, is it fair to say that Cromwell banned Christmas? And if not, where did this story begin? It's certainly true that during Cromwell's reign as Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of England, Scotland and Ireland from 1653 to 1658, stricter laws were passed to catch anyone holding or attending a special Christmas church service. From 1656, legislation was enacted to ensure that every Sunday was stringently observed as a holy day, the Lord's Day. By contrast, shops and markets were told to stay open on 25th December, and in the City of London, soldiers were ordered to patrol the streets, seizing any food they discovered being prepared for Christmas celebrations. It's important, however, to consider these measures within the context of the Puritan movement that began in the 16th century. Christmas then, as now, was a time of both long-cherished rituals and excessive social behaviour. From the mid-1500s, objections to supposedly frivolous additions to the religious calendar, like Christmas, were voiced by Puritan leaders and pamphleteers like Philip Studs. They saw Christmas as a wasteful festival that threatened Christian beliefs and encouraged immoral activities. To, in Stubbs's words, the great dishonour of God. The discontent fell within the Puritan community towards festivals led to the enactment of forceful legislation even before Cromwell's protectorate. In January 1645, Parliament produced a new directory for public worship that made clear that festival days, including Christmas, were not to be celebrated but spent in respectful contemplation. On 19th December 1643, an ordinance was passed encouraging subjects to treat the midwinter period with the more solemn humiliation because it may call to remembrance our sins and the sins of our forefathers who have turned this feast, pretending the memory of Christ, into an extreme forgetfulness of him by giving liberty to carnal and sensual delights. The rejection of Christmas as a joyful period was reiterated when a 1644 ordinance confirmed the abolition of the feasts of Christmas, Easter and Whitsun. From this point until the Restoration in 1660, Christmas was officially illegal. Although Cromwell himself did not initiate the banning of Christmas, his rise to power certainly resulted in the promotion of measures that severely curtailed such celebrations. Nevertheless, the Puritans' prohibition of Christmas proved very unpopular and pro-Christmas riots broke out. Cromwell is the subject of two listed statues. He stands outside the House of Commons in Westminster, as well as perching atop the plinth at Market Hill in St. Ives. The latter statue is bronze and set on a Portland stone base, which is approached by a step. Paid for by public subscription, it was created around 1901 by the sculptor F.W. Pomeroy. Although it was erected about 340 years after Cromwell's death, some officials of the town still could not bring themselves to attend the ceremony to unveil it, proving that the former Lord Protector remained a controversial figure centuries on. When Christmas approaches, let's remember how lucky we are that the smell of our turkey being cooked and holly decorating our front door won't make us liable for arrest.
TNF Soundings.
Hello everyone. I hope that you're all safe and well and ticking off the remaining days to Christmas and opening the doors in your advent calendars. I'm like a big kid over mine, and mine's got Cadbury's chocolate this year. Anyway, let's get on with it and see what little gems are behind this week's Did You Know door. Now then, did you know that it was on the 1st of December 1990 that our island became joined to mainland Europe for the first time since the Ice Age 25,000 years ago, when workers from the UK met those from France 40 metres below the English Channel to form the Channel Tunnel. It was open to rail traffic on May 1994. And December got its name from the Latin word decem, meaning 10, because it was originally the 10th month of the year in the calendar of the 8th century Roman calendar, which began in March. The winter days following December were not included as part of any month. Later, the months of January and February were created out of the monthless period and added to the beginning of the calendar, but December retained its name. Advent, our traditional run-up to Christmas, was originally a period of fasting before the feasts of Christmas. Unlike Lent, the run-up to Easter, which continued to be observed, the fasting in Advent fell into disuse. The reason mincemeat that we use in mince pies is called meat is because that's exactly what it used to be. Most often it was mutton, but also of beef, rabbit, pork or game. Mince pies were first served in the early Middle Ages, and the pies were quite sizeable, filled with a mixture of finely minced meat, chopped up fruit and a preserving liquid. Mincemeat originally came about as a good way of preserving meat, without salting, curing, smoking or drying it. And the origin of advent calendars harks back to Germany, when a little candle was lit each day on the run-up to Christmas. They became popularised in the late 1900s with the introduction of printed card calendars with little doors to open. Nowadays, of course, behind each door there are little gifts of chocolate or trinkets to surprise each day. Mistletoe was a plant of peace in antiquity. According to Norse legend, it was connected to the Freya, the goddess of love and beauty. And a man had to kiss any young girl who, without realising it, found herself accidentally under a sprig of mistletoe hanging from the ceiling. So, I hope this week's items have kick-started the Christmas spirit in you. It's certainly done it for me. With the promise of chocolate, mince pies and all the other Christmas goodies that are on offer in the coming weeks. I've also discovered that Christmas pud should have 13 ingredients that represent the participants of the Last Supper. In your road up. If that's the case, I'm off to check the label on my puds that I bought from Aldi. I don't want to be shortchanged. Till next week then, I'll sign off. Ta-ra a bit. Ta-ra!
Hi, my name is Ashley and I'm the Citizens Network Connector at Midland Mencap. And today I'd just like to introduce to you a new project that we're working on alongside the West Midlands Combined Authority and the Activity Alliance that I'd love for you to be part of. Did you know that the West Midlands has the highest level of physical inactivity than anywhere else in England? Also, one in five people within this region either have a disability or long-term health condition, and a staggering 49% of that one in five does little to no physical activity throughout the week, and that needs to change. Include Me Citizens Network is a social movement that's designed to be a user-led voice for people with a disability, long-term health condition, as well as their parents, carers and other family members, to work in collaboration with the West Midlands Combined Authority and help encourage the positive changes that are needed to improve accessibility. And ultimately enable our minority groups to develop a lifelong enjoyment and participation of physical activity and sport in a way that's fully accessible for them. Living with a disability myself and having an absolute love and passion for physical activity and sport, I'm well aware of the day-to-day challenges being physically active can entail due to limited accessibility. And that's why I think becoming involved with the Citizens Network is the very first step in allowing us all to develop a louder voice and encourage the changes that are needed to make the West Midlands the best it possibly can be for accessibility. And what better time to start taking action and make our voices louder than in the midst of a pandemic when everyone is planning and preparing for a new normal? Let's make that new normal more accessible for us together. If this is something that you'd like to get involved in, you can email me at ashley.jones@midlandmencap.org.uk. And Ashley is spelled A-S-H-L-E-I-G-H. Alternatively, you can call me on 07912-269-035. Thank you for listening today, and I look forward to hearing from you soon.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, I'm Nikki. And here's an article from Optometry Today. You shouldn't let a disability stop you from pursuing a dream. Fresh from Tokyo 2020, three visually impaired Paralympians tell OT about their experiences. Daniel Powell, judo. Daniel Powell, 30, from Liverpool, lives with Stargardt's disease. He returned from injury to compete in Tokyo 2020, finishing 7th. Did you have a specific support for your vision whilst in Tokyo? Our coach and support staff have specifically supported our needs as visually impaired people. However, I feel not enough was done regarding supporting visually impaired people within the village. The village itself was poorly lit from the accommodation to walking around. The dining area was not visually impaired friendly, and with the anxiety around making everything sanitary, looking up close to see foods was frowned upon. There were limited English-speaking staff, so the staff that were available were unable to tell you what the food was. I personally ended up eating the same meals because of this. How was it to know that your partner, Libby Clegg, was competing in these games too? It must have been encouraging to be there together. After missing out on Rio 2016, I set out to qualify for the Tokyo Games in a sport I hadn't done for 4 years, so that I could experience going to the Paralympic Games with my family. It has been an amazing thing to share this experience with my partner. It has been a great opportunity to be able to support each other during these high-pressure times. You had time out of judo between 2013 and 2018. What made you return to it? I returned to judo because I missed the physicality of the sport, something you don't just get with athletics. I also hugely enjoy the training and the intensity of each session, either in the gym or on the mat. What would you say to others with visual impairments who want to pursue a dream, sporting or otherwise, but feel nervous or like they might not have the support to do so? The support is out there, but that from understanding coaches or people who can fill in the gaps that visual impairment leaves. However, it always needs to start with a level of motivation to put one foot in front of the other and get started. Ellen Buttrick, rowing. Paralympic gold medalist Ellen Buttrick from Leeds was diagnosed with Stargardt's disease while at university in 2014. Fresh from her success at Tokyo's 2020, she discusses her journey to her third top place medal. Did rowing come before or after your diagnosis? Before. I started rowing in 2012 during the week of the London Olympics. It was during the 2012 Paralympics that I recognised the resilience of the Paralympic athletes. And that memory was what I drew on 2 years later when I was diagnosed with my sight impairment that classifies me for para rowing. How do you manage your Stargardt's disease whilst you're competing? Was there support for you in Tokyo? We have a cox in our boat who steers and gives direction during training and in the race. She also looks out for me, as do the rest of my teammates. I am still independent, but if I need to read or find something, my teammates are always happy to help. This was most useful in the food hall at the Athlete Village. The food hall is two stories with food from all over the world available, so that every nationality can find something to eat. Unfortunately, the font explaining each dish was pretty small, so I needed guidance when selecting my food so that I didn't go too rogue. What adaptations do you have and how do they help you? In the boat, I don't really need adaptations because I'm not required to read anything. I just need to move in time with the rest of the crew. On land, though, I have magnification software on the rowing machine and bikes, and during tests, a coach or cox will read out my speeds to me so that I can stay on track. After winning gold in Tokyo, you've now been a world champion 3 times. How does that feel? Pretty incredible. I would never have expected this level of success when I first set my mind on becoming a Paralympian. I've been very fortunate to join GB's PR3 Mixed Coxed 4, which this year celebrated its 11th year of gold medal success. Joining such a successful crew meant that I was able to develop very quickly as an athlete and understand the high standards that were required from me. What would you say to others with visual impairments who want to pursue a dream, sporting or otherwise, but feel nervous or like they might not have the support to do so? I have found that it can be more difficult to try to pursue certain things with a sight impairment, but that shouldn't stop you from trying. Personally, I just see it as an even bigger achievement once I succeed. You shouldn't let a disability stop you from pursuing a dream. The support is out there. It's sometimes just difficult to find. But once you find it, like I did with my para-rowing squad, amazing things can happen. Jack Hodgson, judo. Jack Hodgson, 25, from Gainsborough, has retinitis pigmentosa and hearing loss. He explains how teammates have driven his career and why visual impairment shouldn't be a barrier to success. How has the Tokyo experience been? Have you managed to socialise, etc., with your teammates, as you might have done pre-pandemic, or has it been very different? The whole experience has been very different in terms of restrictions and rules. However, the buzz and atmosphere of the village remained. Japan did an amazing job at keeping us as safe as possible. We managed to socialise with our own teammates because we were in a bubble and we got to see other people on the circuit in some capacity, which was amazing after the year we've had. The whole village environment was buzzing because I think that, as athletes, we needed this more than ever. As well as retinitis pigmentosa, you also live with hearing loss. How is the process of managing that whilst competing? Have you had support from medics whilst in Tokyo this summer? As a team, we are very close and we all help each other out with any issues that we have. In terms of competition day, I am very used to competing without any hearing, and everybody on the circuit has sight loss, so that's to be expected. Fortunately, judo is one of those sports where when you're competing, you are competing by yourself, so you're not required to hear. Myself and my coaches have developed a basic rudimentary form of communication for judo using hand signs. How did you find the move into the classified category of judo almost a decade ago? I sort of fell into visually impaired judo seamlessly as the diagnosis of my vision coincided with London 2012 Paralympics, where the Paralympic movement really seemed to take off. Before 2012, not many people knew about Paralympic judo. In particular, what the team achieved and the coverage Channel 4 did of that particular games really inspired me and our current team as the next generation. One of the British coaches that I was training with at the time, and local coach to me, is now the Paralympic head coach, and he has done an amazing job in bringing up the next team. You train at the British Judo Centre of Excellence. How have they accommodated your visual impairment? Have they been supportive? The British Judo Olympic and Paralympic National Training Centre has been unbelievably supportive of visually impaired judo. I believe it is one of the only fully integrated programmes, which means that both sighted and visually impaired fighters trained together at all times. As a disabled athlete, you can't ask for anything more inclusive than full inclusion. Obviously, this presents some challenges, and the entire team and staff are really good with helping us out. That's not to say we are not the butt of some jokes, because we have had some spectacular fails as a team.
DNF Soundings.
Hello, I'm Craig, and I'm going to tell you some jokes from your Black Country Joke book. Did you hear about the two blokes from King's Winford that stole the calendar? They each got 6 months. Here's another one for you. What's the difference between a buffalo and a bison? You could wash your hands in a buffalo. And finally, two men walked into a bar in Dudley. You thought at least one of them would have ducked. I'm Craig, and that was from a Black Country Joke book.
Up now, we have the answers to this week's quiz. How did you do? Well, now's the time to find out. Question 1. How long ago was the last ice age? And the answer? 25,000 years ago. Question 2. Why is December so cold? And the answer? In ancient Roman calendars, it was the 10th month. Question 3. What is the run-up to Christmas called? And of course, the answer is Advent. Question 4. Why is mincemeat in our mince pies so cold? And the answer to this one is because in the Middle Ages, it was actually minced meat that was used. Question 5. Where did the idea of advent calendars originate? And the answer? Germany. And finally, question 6. Who was the Norse goddess of love and beauty? And the answer to this one is Freya. I hope you did well this week. But if not, we'll have more to ponder over next time, courtesy of our question setter, Flashback Roger. Up now, though, we have an audio book review.
DNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Deborah Heath is with me again to talk about a book, an audiobook, Midwich Cuckoos by John Wyndham. Now, John Wyndham was writing in the 1950s, thereabouts.
He started before that. He was brought up in quite a privileged family and wrote because he didn't have to earn an income. Eventually he did, so I think he started just before the war, and he did a few books with his real surname, which wasn't Wyndham, it was something else. Wyndham was one of his middle names, and he messed around with all 5 or 6 of his names. And then he had a very interesting Second World War, which I'm sure has affected his writing. He was involved in cracking ciphers, and was also, strangely, in the Home Guard. He was a fire watcher, and eventually he did go into the forces. When the war finished, his brother had started to be quite a prolific writer, and I suppose he felt a bit jealous, so he thought he would change his style. So the books we associate with him, certainly under this name, tend to be science fiction.
The title, The Midwich Cuckoos, has got two key words to it. Midwich, which is the name of the place,
yes,
which is a village, and that's where the story starts, yes, in and around that village. And it's all about that, what becomes the Midwich Day Out,
yes,
a day that disappears from the calendar. And the cuckoos is because it takes the idea of what the cuckoo actually does, which is get into somebody else's nest and lay its egg, and that egg has a dramatic effect on the rest of the eggs in that nest.
Yes, so it takes over. It hatches before the mother bird's real eggs, and it demands much more of her attention and often pushes the other eggs and birds out of the nest. That's very relevant to the story.
Now, we're sort of teasing, we're playing around with this, but before we get into the plot itself, there's a lot of narration in this, isn't there? There's a lot of talk by the author, if you like, or by his principal character, his narrator.
It's interesting. And I think we should touch on that a bit later when we're sort of summarising the book. But let's talk about the role of the narrator. It's quite an interesting one because the narrator doesn't really take part in the story. He lives in Midwich, but has taken a day off. So he comes back and says at the beginning that he's collected people's memories. They might not be quite in the right order, but he is basically a reporter. He reports back to us. And although he is present during some of the strange things that go on, he is very much an outsider.
The story really begins with him and his wife. They were out for the day. They came back to their village, Midwich, but couldn't get through.
What happened was that everyone was carrying on their normal business, and then suddenly everything stopped.
From 10:17 that night, information about Midwich becomes episodic. Its telephones remained dead. The bus that should have passed through it failed to reach Stouch, and a truck that went to look for the bus did not return. A notification from the RAF was received in train of some unidentified flying object. Not, repeat not, a service machine, detected by radar in the Midwich area, possibly making a forced landing. Someone in Opley reported a house on fire in Midwich, with apparently nothing being done about it. The train fire appliance turned out and thereafter failed to make any reports. The train police dispatched a car to find out what had happened to the fire engine, and that too vanished into silence. Opley reported a second fire, and still seemingly nothing being done. Constable Gobby in Stouch was rung up and sent off on his bicycle to Midwich, and no more was heard of him, either.
People were on the telephone and suddenly everything went dead. People were on a bus and the driver stopped driving and everyone froze.
There were people who died as a result of this, what we call the day out, and we'll come to explain it more as we go through, a day when something happened. And therefore the police first, I guess, and then the army.
Yeah, so it all becomes a little bit top secret, doesn't it? And I must say I lost track of which government agencies were involved. But nevertheless, they had some very clever scientists and military officials in to come and see what had happened. And what they worked out was that it was not only sort of the ground level of Midwich that had been affected, but also the height. So they sent an aeroplane up to do investigations, and it didn't end very well for the people in that aeroplane. So think of it in effect like a sort of a dome where inside everything stopped. So they did a few experiments, including, I felt very sorry for the canary in a cage, but they found a canary.
He lowered his pole from the vertical, and with the cage still dangling at its end, thrust it forward tentatively. The bird fell off its perch and lay on the sanded floor of the cage. The corporal withdrew the cage. The bird gave a slightly indignant tweet and hopped back on its perch. One watching private stepped forward with his bucket and daubed a little whitewash on the grass. The other made a mark on his map. The party then moved along a dozen yards or so and repeated the performance.
They couldn't see it, they couldn't smell it, they couldn't feel it.
Yes.
But there was this dome of something. And in fact, the narrator and his wife both tried to avoid the police blockage and the army blockage by going across the fields, and they consecutively collapse into sleep. When they're brought back out, memorably by a pole with a boat hook on the end, as it were, by somebody, pulls them back up, they wake up again. So it's not fatal. Whatever this is not fatal.
But people are very confused about it. Eventually, the effects wear off, and it seems that everything returns to normal in Midwich. It's just referred to colloquially as the day out, and everybody carries on with their business as if nothing had happened. And I think the government have done quite a good job of covering it up and keeping it hush-hush.
Because there is a mysterious ministry building inside that village.
Yes,
I think it was the Grange.
The Grange,
taken over by a ministry for research. We never really get to the bottom of this.
We don't know what's going on there.
Anyway, so the Grange is there, something's going on, but as you say, the police, the authorities keep it very quiet. You don't get a lot of media reporting on it. It's really quite covered up. And then something happens a bit later.
After a few weeks, maybe a couple of months, the women of Midwich, well, a lot of the women, start to notice some changes, namely that they appear to be pregnant. The strange thing about this is that some of them have had no means of getting pregnant, and it's all a little bit of a surprise.
Farrellyn ate some cornflakes, drank some coffee, and accepted a fried egg and bacon. After two nibbles, she pushed the plate away decisively enough to arouse Angela from her reflections. "What's the matter?" Angela inquired from her end of the table. "Isn't it fresh?" "Oh, there's nothing wrong with it," Farrellyn told her. "I just don't happen to feel eggy this morning, that's all." Angela seemed uninterested. When one had half hoped she would ask why... An inside voice seemed to prompt Farrellyn. Why not now? After all, it can't really make much difference when, can it? So she took a breath. By way of introducing the matter gently, she said, As a matter of fact, Angela, I was sick this morning. Oh? Indeed, said her stepmother, and paused while she helped herself to butter. In the act of raising her marmaladed toast, she added, So was I. Horrid, isn't it?
It's all the women who are of childbearing age, isn't
exactly.
it? So if they were older than that, they weren't affected. If they were younger than that, they weren't affected. It's all the women who were in a position where, because of their age and their health and whatever else, were able to become pregnant.
Yes. So we have some teenagers and we have some older maiden ladies. Oh, very shocking indeed for those maiden ladies. And they go and see the vicar about it. And eventually all the bigwigs of the town, including the vicar, the doctor and Zellaby himself, he's an academic, moral philosophy or something. I'm not quite sure.
And it's his daughter and his wife, Angela was the second or third wife, I can't remember which, but his daughter, Farrellyn, that we're talking earlier.
Yes.
So this is the husband. He's older than his wife.
Yes.
He's, as you say, an academic. He gets very interested in the detail of this and has a lot to say about various things. Mm. And he lives in the other big house in the village, I think that's...
That's right. So the bigwigs get together and Angela leads a talk for all the women who are affected, and she's basically saying, you know, we've got to get through it together. We don't know what's going on. It's all a bit strange, but we need to keep it quiet, keep our heads down and not tell anyone outside of Midwich. And so they continue in their pregnancies. They're obviously very worried, but they do some form of scan. I think they're talking about x-rays. It seems very dangerous to give x-rays to pregnant women now, doesn't it? But they can tell that the babies are developing normally and seem to be large and healthy. And eventually these babies are born and seem to be absolutely perfect, apart from a slightly strange thing that they all have golden eyes.
They're all growing at the same age. I mean, they've all started at the same time, on the same day, the Midwich day out. I think, as far as I remember, not all of them survive the pregnancy.
Yes.
There are a few fatalities.
A bit later, when they were a couple of months old, there was some influenza in the village and some of them died, including Farrellyn's child. But the interesting thing is that as these children develop, they develop much more quickly than one would expect. So we're left with infants, really, who have the mental processes of a 4 or 5 year old. Zellaby is very quick to notice this and conducts a few experiments. So Zellaby gathers some important people, including the narrator and his wife, and shows them something very interesting. One by one, he approaches some of the girls and boys separately. So starting with a boy, he teaches it a trick, how to get a barley sugar out of a box, quite an intricate box. Then he goes to the next boy. But this boy doesn't have to learn how to do it like the first boy. He just instinctively does it, even though he's only about 1 or 2 years old. Then he goes to a girl. The first girl has to learn how to perform the trick as well. The second girl instinctively knows how to do it.
Mr. Zellaby, are you claiming that if I were to tell anything to any one of the boys, all the rest would know it?
Certainly. Provided, of course, that it was something simple enough for them to understand at this stage.
Janet looked highly sceptical. Zellaby sighed.
The old trouble, he said. Lynch Darwin and you show the impossibility of evolution. But, as I said, you've only to apply your own tests.
And what he concludes is that there is a collective individualism. Specifically, there is one male identity and one female identity, which is really very curious.
We don't have here one single group en rapport. We have two separate groups of rapport, apparently without cross-connections. Now, if that is so, and we have seen that it is, a question that immediately presents itself is this. To what extent is any of these children an individual? Each is physically an individual, as we can see, but is he so in other ways? If he is sharing consciousness with the rest of the group instead of having to communicate with others with difficulty, as we do, can he be said to have a mind of his own, a separate personality, as we understand it? I don't see that he can.
And as you say, they are older than their years all the way through. They appear to be growing at a faster rate. Both physically and intellectually?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So they're very large, they're very strong. And eventually, this creeps everyone out so much that all the children are encouraged, or actually I think they choose, to go and live at the Grange. It's interesting to note that the children don't want to leave Midwich. So sometimes the parents will try to take them out in the car. But there's just some sort of strange force that always brings them back again. So they have to live in the village. And eventually, Angela escapes, leaving her child behind. So the children are eventually living at the Grange together.
Now, there's a limit to how far we can go. And the tricky thing about this is that almost anything we say beyond this point is going to give the plot away.
Yes.
Because these kids have got a certain sort of characteristics and certain sort of natures which become more and more relevant to the story.
Yes.
And they dictate what happens.
Yes. So we want to leave it at a place where things are intriguing. It is very intriguing and you want to read on. So I think this is the place to stop discussing the plot.
I mean, it does roll along. I felt at first when I was reading it thinking, this feels like a 1950s movie, which is an odd thing to think. It has that sort of pedanticism of the narration falling on and forward and forward and forward. And you think, oh, come on, start jumping corners, because, you know, nowadays we don't have that level of continuous narration.
That's right. And it was referred to by someone as a cozy catastrophe. That's absolutely what it is. It is cozy. It does feel 1950s, but it's certainly a catastrophe. There are quite a few deaths in this book. It's quite a horrible book. And yet you feel quite comforted by it at the same time.
And in fact, I quite enjoyed it because it had that, there was a coziness about it. I think there's various levels under this. I think that some of the other writers later have brought this out. So there's a sort of moral issues being raised here. There's an illustration I'd love to give about this, but I can't because that would give away the half the plot. But there are things you think, okay, then this author is actually trying to say more than just tell a story. I enjoyed it as a storytelling.
Yeah.
I got a little bit irritated by it at times.
Yes.
Because it's a bit of, I'd like to explain this to you again slowly. Is that what I mean by narration?
Yeah, he just goes off on a tangent, doesn't he?
It is because nature is ruthless, hideous and cruel beyond belief that it was necessary to invent civilization. One thinks of wild animals as savage, but the fiercest of them begins to look almost domesticated when one considers the viciousness required of a survivor in the sea. As for the insects, their lives are sustained only by intricate process of fantastic horror. There is no conception more fallacious than the sense of coziness implied by Mother Nature. Each species must strive to survive, and that it will do, by every means in its power, however foul. Unless the instinct to survive is weakened by conflict with another instinct. Angela seized the pause to put in with a touch of impatience. I've no doubt you're gradually working round to something, Gordon. Yes, Zellaby owned. I'm working round again to cuckoos. Cuckoos are very determined survivors, so determined that there is really only one thing to be done with them, once one's nest is infested. I am, as you know, a humane man. I think I may even say a kindly man by disposition. You may, Gordon. As a further disadvantage, I am a civilized man. For these reasons, I shall not be able to bring myself to approve of what ought to be done, nor even when we perceive its advisability with the rest of us. So like the poor hen thrush, we shall feed and nurture the monster and betray our own species.
This is typical, really, of Zellaby. He goes off on one. He's an academic. He is possibly John Wyndham's mouthpiece.
Although Wyndham uses somebody else as his narrator, he's actually got two narrators in
that
sense,
hasn't he? Yeah, he's exploring ideas. He's playing devil's advocate. And in fact, the narrator's wife, Janet, approaches him from another point of view altogether. So she really challenges Zellaby. So they're all very scientific in their way. What I've concluded, having read the book now twice and watched the film, is this is a cracking story, but it's not a great book. It starts off, probably the first half is really good. It rolls along. It's very engaging. But like you, I got frustrated at some of the asides. But I do think it's worth reading because the story is so good and because it does give a lot of opportunity for discussion with other people who've read it. So when I finished it, I wanted you to read it. I wanted my husband to read it. I just wanted to discuss it with someone. It's a very, very good story with some interesting things to say.
And it certainly develops the characters. You know who these people, you can visualise these people. That's why I said it felt like a 1950s film, because I could see them through the text, which is quite clever to do, I think, for a writer, because you're not just stuck in the words, where you can actually visualise it very easily.
So you read it in book form?
I read it in book form.
Okay, so of course I had to listen to it because of my eyesight issues, and it's read by Nathaniel Parker. It's absolutely brilliant. I have some issues with audiobooks because people like me are forced to listen to them because we can't read ourselves. But often what you're getting is the interpretation of the narrator. So you can never come to it completely cold, really. You've always got someone else's ideas there. At times, that is very frustrating. Nathaniel Parker here reads in such an animated fashion, and yet you kind of don't notice him reading it, and that's absolutely how it should be. He gets into each character, he paints a picture, and I think this is a really good example of a very talented audiobook narrator. So I enjoyed something that I wasn't expecting to enjoy.
Good. Well, that's we're talking about the book, The Midwich Cuckers, and about the cuckers themselves, these kids who are born with these golden eyes and the blonde hair and powers that we learn more and more about as we go on. It's narrated, as you said, by Nathaniel Parker. It lasts for approximately 6.5 hours, so it's not a huge listen, which is good. Thank you very much, Debbie, for talking about that
book. You're welcome.
And our thanks go, as ever, to Calibre Audio for providing us with a CD from which we could take those extracts.
TNF Soundings.
With my penchant for matters historical, my postbag off to tracts unbelievable tales from days of yore. Recently, an letter flooded in from an subscriber. I have no reason to doubt its validity, so, in the interests of maintaining accuracy and keeping the record of events factual, I am pleased to reproduce it here in full. Let my correspondent tell you, in his own remarkable words. Lest we forget, a tale of true heroes. Sir, over the years, I have followed with interest the tales of derring-do involving intrepid motorcyclists accomplishing wonderfully foolhardy things on their machines. Lawrence of Arabia crossing continents on his Brough Superior, the legendary Evil Knievel crossing the Grand Canyon on his Harley-Davidson, and, more recently, my next-door neighbour crossing Wolverhampton city centre on his Honda 90 in the school holidays, and living to tell the tale, I might add. However, I feel that as I approach my 95th summer, it is high time I put the historical record straight by revealing my own exploits, which, I am proud to relate, took place as long ago as World War II, when, as a much younger and fitter, and probably more foolhardy man, I utilised my previously moribund experience as one of the Flying Ferrets Motorcycle Circus Troop, and volunteered for active duty in the newly formed and highly sensitive War Allies New Knowledge Executive for Research and Science. Or for short, the WANK. Yes, yes, you get the idea, but this was war. As you'll appreciate, much of our work was top secret, but I feel that after a lifetime of silence, I have earned the right to acknowledge the existence of our group and highlight the brave contribution of our lads. Much of our exploits have been lost in the mists of time, but it was one particularly suicidal operation that sticks in the memory, and it involves the absolutely true story behind the sinking of the enemy battleship Tirpitz in South America in the year of our Lord, 1943. Prior to the war, you understand, all exports of steel from the UK were restricted, and it was under much cover of darkness that I was one of a team involved in sewing up old BSA B40 motorcycles with sidecars on them and exporting them incognito for use on the isolated dirt tracks of the Amazon, where they are in desperately short supply to shore up their burgeoning banana trade. In much the same way as Saddam Hussein later tried concealing his supergun, although, of course, he was more interested in Middle East and eventual world domination than bananas. But you see my point. Anyway, I well recall how whole sections of sidecar, for example, were shipped disguised as artificial leg replacements to be later smelted in secret kilns deep in the forest and rebuilt as motorcycles with tradesmen's sidecars by highly skilled South American craftsmen from the Kapi tribe. I also recall with pride how craftily the tribe members contrived to help us, and their leader, a strapping lad of 3'10" tall and with the title of world's tallest dwarf already to his credit, himself had the remarkable distinction of possessing an artificial leg with a real foot on the end. Strange. Truly an amazing man, but let me not digress. This surreptitious trade continued unrecognised and undisturbed until my team and I were asked to modify a reconstructed single-cylinder thumper of an engine with twin air flotation bags and a small brass propeller wired to its lay shaft, and which, because of its size, could thus avoid coastal radar, with forward torpedo tubes, and set out undercover to ram the Tirpitz battleship moored in the harbour. We knew the regular Navy could supply covering fire, but were unable to score a direct hit due to jungle coverage, and so we ventured out, pointed the outfit at Tirpitz, and dived overboard just as she collided head-on. We were but lads at the time, but we were already battle-hardened enough to understand the awfulness of war, and I recall the sickening roar of the explosion in my ears before passing out and waking up in a hospital bed back in Blighty. Mission successfully accomplished. But it was to be no hero's welcome for me. A man from the ministry made me sign all manner of documents, including a secrecy clause and NHS deafness disclaimer, and nothing more was ever mentioned of our exploits. Though I do believe that the cinematic version of The African Queen, in which Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn get married on a German battleship just before the torpedoes in The African Queen strike and sink the enemy ship, to the strains of Ich bin getting married in das morning, the last bit later sub-edited out, I gather, was a backhanded compliment to our own efforts in real life. In a singularly curious coincidence, I also note that at precisely the same time the Tirpitz went down, taking our erstwhile floating motorcycle with it, the South American banana export market dipped temporarily commensurate with a discernible change in skill patterns in the Kapi tribe, who ventured more profitably into cocaine production, at which they are now recognised world leaders. I trust this is of interest to your listeners. And if any of my old biking chums are out there hearing this, especially Norris Skip Cuthbert and Alfonso Daggerman Pirelli, then I would love to hear from you after all these years, whilst we still have time on our sides. I am, sir, faithfully yours, Surgeon Commander H. Dorrington Gusset, RN, brackets retired. Now care of the Abider Wee Home for Retired Gentlefolk, Gornal, brackets upper, the Black Country. Gosh! A wonderful recollection from a very brave man for whom, and for the record, I have no hesitation in appending my own counter-signature and a caption which reads thus. I verify this to be an accurate verbal transcript of a letter signed by the above and laid before me one anonymous Sunday afternoon. Signed, Graham Fisher, no relation.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening And thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who, without their support, we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!